So first of all, what is it that we want to compute, or what is it that is the main object of interest? So that would be scattering amplitudes. In what theory? Well, in n equals 4 super gem mills. Of course, we hope that the things that we're doing here are more general. We know that many of them are more general, but perhaps one of the main targets is to extend this to gravity or n equals 8 super gravity. So you can take that as your homework problem, okay? And if you do it, then you just have to type it in and put it in the archive. So what is n equals 4 super gem mills? Well, it's a theory that has particles with helicity lesser equal than 1, okay? And yesterday, we described the one particle states using magic variables, okay? So A was a particle index. And we introduce a Grassmann parameter, or a set of Grassmann parameters, in order to encode all the helicity, all the particles, all the one particle states in the n equals 4 supermultiplet in a single object. And that was obtained by acting on the one particle state of a gluon with plus helicity with a Q-bar operator contracted with the air. Okay? Very good. Now, we also said that a trick when you have particles that carry color is to talk about color ordering and separate scattering amplitudes. We call them MN, which, of course, are permutation invariant. They are supposed to be permutation invariant. There is no sense in which we can say, oh, we are scattering particle 1, then particle 2 is next to particle 1, and so on. But it's convenient to separate them depending on the color structure in front of the Feynman diagrams. And we collect all of them with the same color structure into a single object and sum over permutations, modular cyclic permutations, okay? And we said that this is the object we're considering, and that's why we have an induced cyclic ordering. All right, very good. And the purpose is to compute these to all orders in perturbation theory. Not only that, we will also take one more approximation, which can be done when you have color structure, which is to go to the planar limb. I said that n equals 4 super gem mills was a gauge theory. We'll take the gauge group to be un, and we will take n to be large. Okay. Very good. So I also gave you the three particle amplitude, fully supersymmetric, but I also gave you a whole multiplicity, that's how it's called, an all multiplicity amplitude, which is the Park-Taylor amplitude. Well, this is not quite the way Park and Taylor wrote the amplitude, because they only wrote it for a particular component where you had only gluons, two gluons with negative helicity and the rest with plus helicity, but it gave you the full supersymmetric version. The first part, the numerator, we argue could be derived by symmetry principles. Simply by imposing that your scattering amplitude is invariant on the translations, you immediately conclude that this must be there. That your scattering amplitude is invariant under Susi transformations, you conclude that this must be there. And the rest, well, the rest is what our friends told us was there. Okay? So this is a fully Susi amplitude. I introduce a notion of a are charged. Okay? I said that if you scale eta of a given, all the etas by t eta, okay, your amplitude will scale as t to the fourth some power, okay? And that power would be the R charge. Yesterday I used K for that, but I realized that that will not be very convenient today. So I have to apologize, but we will change the name of that number and we will call it M. Okay? Well, can you tell me what would be the M of the Park-Taylor amplitude? Well, that's very easy, right? This is a fermionic delta function. So the M is 2. Excellent. So M is 2. So Park and Taylor computed the whole amplitude, the whole set of amplitudes in the M equals 2 sector. That's how we say it. Okay. Now, how do you go back to the Park-Taylor formula? Remember that I told you that Park and Taylor told you what happens when you have particles where all particles that you are scattering are gluons. All of them with plus helicity, except for two of them, which we have minus helicity. How do you extract that from here? Well, that's very easy, right? Just look at this. So all the particles that you want, except for two, must be plus helicity. So all you have to do is to integrate over all eras with a measure that completely eats up all the eras already. So you can set the eras coming from here to zero, so you pick up this state. That's in words. In practice, what I mean is that you integrate over all eras of the particles that have plus helicity, okay, different from I and J, with all the eras here, okay. I'm not getting zero. Why? Why am I not getting zero? What do I mean by this eta to the fourth? Well, what I mean by that is the product of all the four etas, right? That's the only thing that is non-zero, really. So I have that. Now, for the particles that I want minus helicity, I have to pick up, I have to allow the supercharge to act fully, all it can, okay? All four terms, I need them. So what I do in order to enforce that is that I just integrate over the four eras, and I don't put anything here, so I need all four eras from the scattering amplitude, okay? Now here goes the fully supersymmetric scattering amplitude, which is a formula we have over here, but only this piece depends on eta. So it's very easy to perform these integrations. This is telling us set the eras of those particles to zero. We don't need any more. We are saturating the fermionic integral. Don't set these ones to zero, otherwise you will get zero. But what we will do, we have to perform these integrals. And this is a nice exercise for you to show that if you have this, remember only two of these ones survive. Okay? But this is nothing but the factor Park and Taylor got initially. Very good. Now, there is something very easy we can conclude immediately from this point of view, and it's the following. Imagine that you want to compute an amplitude, or Park and Taylor said, well, we did this one. Why don't you go home and try the one where only one particle has negative helicity and the rest will have plus? Would you just do it? Well, let's try. We know that whatever it is, it must have this factor because it's supersymmetric, right? So we are supposed to also integrate over the four eras of this guy here. Well, it's clear to see that you'll be in trouble because you have eight eras here. You won't be able to eat it up, so you get zero. How about if Park and Taylor tells you, if they tell you to go and compute the all plus amplitude? Well, that one is even more zero, if you wish. It has a zero order eight, this one, compared to this one. Okay, that's very good. Now, I'm telling you this because I want to explain why people usually refer to the Park-Taylor amplitude they call it MHB amplitude. So I'm going to tell you what it means. So first, we could say that the all plus helicity amplitudes is the M equals 0 sector. We have the M equals 1 and the M equals 2. So this one we concluded is 0, this one is 0, and this one is not 0. So why is this called MHB? The reason is the following. Imagine that you want to scatter all plus helicity gluons. Our conventions is that all particles are incoming, okay, as usual in field theory, or all particles outgoing. But this is, of course, not physical, right? In practice, we have some particles incoming and some particles outgoing. So now, if you I really need something heavy. That would be useful. Well, the full amplitude, sorry, the full amplitude, yeah, the full amplitude, any amplitude to all orders in perturbation theory must have this, because this is a symmetry argument, right? So that's very good. So this is true to all orders in perturbation theory. Of course, the three particle amplitude is 0. What are you talking about? Okay. So if we have this amplitude, to make it physical, we should apply a parity transformation on some of them and make them outgoing. But when we do that, we also flip the helicity of the particles. Now you see, we're scattering 3 plus helicity particles and producing only minus helicity particles. So this is what has the right to be called something that violates helicity completely, right? Oh, but this happens to be 0. Okay, so the theory doesn't violate helicity completely. Well, how about flipping one of these guys to be minus? So that would be the M equals 1 sector. Well, too bad, it also vanishes. So almost violating helicity is not even an option. So the best you can do is to have 2 minuses, any number of pluses scattering into any number of minuses here, and that would be non-zero. And that's the first time you violate helicity. That's the maximal way that you can violate helicity in this theory, and this is why this is called maximally helicity violating amplitudes. It's funny that for 4 particles, it's actually the amplitude that preserves helicity, right? Because you scatter 2 pluses and goes, and they go into 2 pluses, or 2 minuses into 2 minuses. So for 4 particles, it's actually the helicity-conserving amplitude, the one that maximally helicity, that violates helicity. Okay, very good. Now, you can go to higher sectors here. And in general for M greater or equal than 3. And what happens is that in each of those sectors, you increase the number of negative helicity gluons. Okay? So people like to say, since the MHB amplitude was so easy to compute, and then the next one was very, very hard to compute, and then the next one was extremely, extremely hard to compute, then people started to give prizes to themselves saying that they have conquered the NMHB sector. So that would be the M equals 3. And then if you were really, really tough, you could do the N squared MHB sector, and so on. Okay? So you could have the N to the K MHB sector. K, as you can see, is related to M by M minus 2. So that's why I decided to change the notation, because I want to use K for the M to the K. Well, yesterday I was using K for the helicity, for the R charge. All right. So yesterday we also talked about the action of the little group. And we said that there would be something nice that happens to our amplitude if we scale lambda A by TA, lambda A tilde by T inverse A, and eta tilde by T inverse eta tilde A. Okay? We said that our amplitude is supposed to go to T to the minus 2. Okay, that's very good. But remember that Nima told you that there was a trick to make this look even nicer. This is a little bit awkward to have this one transform differently from these two. If you could only make it transform, choose new variables to make it transform in the same way, and you were, and when you were in high school, you learned projective geometry, like people used to do in the UK, I guess, many years ago. Then you will immediately say, of course, that's great. That's what you have to do, because then you could put all these guys into a single object, and it would be a projective variable somewhere. So that was the motivation that Nima gave yesterday for taking your amplitude with variables lambda A, lambda A tilde, and eta tilde into a new space, which is basically the Fourier transform. With respect to lambda A, so you introduce the conjugate variable is called mu A tilde. Okay? This bracket is a bracket that is Lorentz invariant. Okay? Remember, lambda A carries an index A. Mu A also carries an index, mu A carries an index B, and these are contracted with epsilon AB. And that's what this means. Well, if you do that, you build a new function. Now variables mu A, lambda tilde A, and eta tilde A. That is spectacular, because under this transformation, you see that mu tilde inherits a transformation of the form T inverse. And moreover, this object, well, first of all, now we are allowed to put all these guys together into a single object that Nima called WA with components mu A, lambda A, and eta A. Okay. Well, as we wanted precisely, this guy transforms homogeneously, so we can talk about this as a single object. Moreover, he showed that this amplitude as a function of W, if you rescale W, you get the same object. So this is, in fact, a function not of W, but it's W modulo any W associated to that by a rescaling by a complex number. Okay? Yes, I do. Yeah.
No, we can do it independently. Yes,
it's a little group transformation, so we can rescale just particle, as one particle, and that should be the scaling for each particle. Very good. So that means that this is not, I mean, naively you would think that this is a vector in C4/4, where this is a supersymmetric part, four supersymmetric directions, but really, our function is really a function in CP3/4. Okay? We eat up one dimension because it's a complex rescaling that we don't care about. So this is great. So our amplitude lives, the data lives in CP3/4. So you could be very happy with that and enjoy talking to your friends about CP3/4 and say how cool things are and so on. But you see, there is something even better than that. There is something much, much better that you can tell that comes precisely from looking at this W. So the scattering data is a set of W's. Let me just take the bosonic part. Okay? Just the bosonic part. Well, imagine that you want to give the scattering data, the NWs of the N particles to somebody, then you write it in a list. So you say, well, okay, so let me write it in a list. Let me put, for particle one, I put it here. For particle two, I put it here as columns of a matrix. Okay? Now, this is a 4 by N matrix, right? Very good. Now, another motivation for going into this description that Nima gave was that these amplitudes not only enjoy Lorentz invariants, right, but they also enjoy conformal invariants. And conformal invariants in the regular space was an awkward action. It had a strange action. But in this space, it had a beautiful action. In fact, it acts simply. This guy is simply acted on in the fundamental representation of SL4. So it acts nicely. You just take a 4x4 matrix in SL4, and you rotate the vector WA. That's very good. So you see that the data is made out of n 4 vectors. Okay? So you have n 4 vectors. But you see that you have this SL4 acting on this, changing the 4 vectors. Okay? Now we like to propose a deep duality. Okay? So the deep duality is the following. Well, n 4 vectors can also be thought of as 4 n vectors. Okay, you just turn your head and you're done. Well, if you did that, you'd say, well, so what? That doesn't look very special. Of course, you now have 4 n vectors. What do you do with that? Well, these 4 n vectors live in Cn. Okay? And these particular 4 n vectors, they span a particular 4 plane in Cn. Okay? Very good. But that would not be very meaningful if all the time I have to give you 4 vectors, right? If I have to give you 4 vectors and specify what the 4 vectors are, that would not, talking about the 4 plane would not be very meaningful. But know the following. SL4 precisely changes the vectors without changing the plane they define. That's remarkable. So the conformal transformations move the 4 vectors in such a way, okay, it acts on this side, in such a way that induces a change of basis of the 4 plane. Now you would say, well, but still you cannot talk about the 4 plane, because the 4 plane doesn't care if you rescale the vectors. Okay? Well, but look at this. Precisely now going back to Neil's comment, if you allow everything to be rescaled by the same factor, the amplitude is also invariant. So the amplitude actually doesn't depend on that much data, the data that we have here. The amplitude is just a function of a particular 4 plane. This symmetry, now in terms of the amplitude, has been enhanced to a GL4 symmetry. Now, if you tell a mathematician that you have a matrix and your function only depends on the matrix modulo, a GL4 transformation, they would immediately say that you have a function that is defined on the Grassmannian G4, n, which is nothing but the space of 4 planes in n dimensions. Okay. So we have discovered that in this new space, which is these Ws or this CP3/4, is what, to be precise, it should be called the dual twister space. Gave us something remarkable. It tells us that the physical data is encoded, or every scattering amplitude is defined by a point in this space, in the space of 4 planes in Cn. Okay? That's right. Yeah. Yes, but But the supersymmetric part will not do very much in our story. All right. Very good. So now that you have that, you're motivated to think about perhaps describing scattering amplitudes or finding the new formulation for the scattering amplitudes that we were looking for, perhaps as something that has to do with Grassmannians. Okay? So there are many ways I could try to motivate what the new formulation that we want to talk about in this course will be. But I think I think that the best way is just to write down what it is. So I'm just going to write down what it is. So the new formulation of the object that we would like to study is the following. We want to consider, motivated by this Grassmannian, by the appearance of this Grassmannian, we want to consider the space of K planes in n dimensions, the Grassmannian GKN. Okay. Actually, MM. So what is this? Just like we did for the Grassmannian G4N, we will talk about the only way that we have in order to describe this Grassmannian, or the only way that I know at least, is to introduce a matrix of K by N. That is K by N, with entries C11, C12, up to C1n, C21, C, sorry. This is a problem when you change notations all the time. M1, M2, all the way to CMn. Okay? This is very analogous to what we do in gauge theory, when we introduce a vector potential. In a sense, we are talking about the space of planes. So we shouldn't be talking about particular bases, right? But the only way that I know to describe this space is by introducing a redundancy. So I have to introduce more variables and mod out by a gauge symmetry. So I want to talk about the GLK, the GLM that acts on this set of n vectors as a gauge symmetry. It is a gauge symmetry, after all, because it's telling me what is the redundancy of the description that I have. Okay? So my variables, my physical variables, are not the space, are not the m times n entries. Okay? These are not my physical variables, but those modulo this. So the set of physical variables, or the dimension of the Grassmannian, is clearly that number minus the number of gauge degrees of freedom that I have to eat the map. And that number is m times n minus m, because the dimension of GLM is m squared. Now, we would like to use coordinates, or mathematicians introduce coordinates that are almost gauge invariant. Okay? The best you can do is to introduce something that is SL invariant. So mathematicians introduce something that are called Plucker coordinates, which is just a fancy name for saying that, well, if you just take any m by m minor of this matrix, okay, take any by m minor, and compute the determinant, say you have columns i1 to im, and you compute this determinant, and you denote this by I1 to IM, this is clearly SLM invariant, right? That transformation preserves the volume of this hypercube, if you wish. But it's not invariant under the rescaling of every entry here, and it will pick up a factor. Now, what mathematicians do is that they give the set of all these Plucker coordinates, and then they think about the Grassmannian as being some space that lives inside some projective space. But that's not very important for us. All we want to use is the coordinates that they have for the SLN, for that are SLN invariant. Okay, now given the coordinates, I can now write down what the new formulation is going to be. The proposal is that this is an integral over the Grassmannian GMN. Of course, I don't know how to integrate directly on the Grassmannian, so the only thing, the best thing I can do at the moment is to integrate over all the entries in the matrix, of which there are m times n. Since this is supposed to be an integral over the Grassmannian, I'm supposed to have a gauge redundancy. So as a good physicist, but not such a good mathematician, I'm going to divide by an infinite volume. I'll divide by the volume of GLM, but we all know what I mean, right? That we will gauge fix using a Fayette-Popov procedure, and then that will pick up the volume, we'll cancel it, and then we will all be happy. Okay. Now, what else? Well, certainly, in order to have this, I need something that, as a whole, is invariant under GLM transformations. So what I'm going to do is to require my plane I want my M plane to be orthogonal to the physical plane. So how do I impose an orthogonality condition? Well, all I need is that every row of this matrix is orthogonal to every row of that matrix. And I want to impose that supersymmetrically. So it will be orthogonal to every row of the supermatrix made out of the four bosonic components and the four fermionic components. So I'll have something that looks like this. Okay. Now this by itself is GL invariant, right? Because it has a fermionic part that eats up the rescaling. This part is SL invariant, right? The measure is SL invariant, because it picks up the determinant of the change of variables. The determinant is 1 if you have an SL transformation, but under a rescaling, it's not invariant. Under a rescaling of all the Cs, the measure will pick up a factor of the form T m times n. So it has to eat up that factor somehow with something that I'll have to compensate with in the denominator. And I'll just tell you what the choice is. For the delta function, yeah, I'm not giving motivation for anything. Yeah. Well, you could say if you want to write something that is super conformal invariant, right? If you want something that is super conformal invariant, the only form that something that is super invariant, we have to be a delta function. Okay? That is the main argument that people give, that people like to give. Now, if you want something that is in the MK sector, you need m delta functions of that form, right? So that is the argument that people give. But as I said, now that we know how to use it and we know what it's computing, I don't think I can give a better motivation than just saying what it is. So now these minors under this transformation, they pick up a factor, they go to P to the M. So if I put N minors in the denominator, I'll be done because I can eat up the transformation of the measure. Now, which N minors are you going to put? Clearly, there are, how many minors are there in this matrix? There are N choose M minors. So randomly, I have to pick N of them. Well, but luckily, in Young-Mills, we said that we have color ordering. So there is a natural ordering. So the natural choice would be to choose the M minors that are ordered with a canonical ordering.
Yes, that's right.
That's right. So I think I said it at some point that we were doing only. Oh, it was. Yeah. All right. Very good. So this is the object. Okay, now I have to tell you, well, at this moment, just like this, you should be unhappy and start complaining about things like, well, this is an integral, what is a contour? What do you do with this? How do you compute something? Well, it turns out that in this formulation, it's not that easy to actually compute things. It's easy to see that anything that you compute with this, which is well-defined, is going to have a remarkable property, which is that it's going to be invariant under SL4/4, which is the superconformal group. So what we conclude from this formulation, written in this form, is that anything that is well-defined that you compute using this is going to be automatically superconformal invariant. Okay? But as I said, this is not quite useful. Yes, as a blackboard that goes up all the time. Let's take it back to momentum space. Well, taking this back to momentum space shouldn't be difficult because we know how we went from momentum space to this space. We perform a Fourier transform.
We go from 4 to m, and what is the motivation also for?
Okay, great, very good. As I said, there is no motivation. Don't keep asking. Yeah, this. So I think that the answer to your question is, if the best answer is a picture, of course. So the picture is the following. You have Cn, okay? Now you have somewhere in your Cn, imagine this is your four-plane, okay? The four-plane over there. This is fixed, this is data. Right? This is your scattering data. Now, the claim is that, again, without motivation whatsoever, that what you're supposed to do is to integrate over the space of m planes in Cn, which are orthogonal to this fixed four plane. So you're integrating over that. Okay. So the number of dimensions is not helping here. Let me try. Okay, let's draw the bigger guy first. Or it could be even smaller, but let's say that this is the M plane. Okay? So you want to integrate over all M planes in Cn such that they are orthogonal. Okay? Mathematicians will kill me if they see that. If they see this. Four planes. Okay, so you're integrating over the space of m planes orthogonal to this four plane. Okay, that's what this formula is telling you, with a particular measure that makes it meaningful to talk about the m plane and not talk about a particular frame in the m plane. Okay. Sorry.
Are you going to sum over m in the end, or what are you going to do with m?
Excellent. Very good question. Yeah. So, remember
we were talking about the different sectors. So, in general, any scattering amplitude can be expanded into sectors, into K charge, M charge sectors. Okay? Now, the claim is that that object computes this part. Very good, very good, very good. Okay? All right. So let's go back to momentum space. The momentum, well, let's see what it looks like in momentum space. You can tell why he's so good, right? He doesn't take no for an answer. Once again, let's go back to momentum space. Okay, very good. So in fact, let me say that this was somehow an L hat. Okay. We're going back to momentum space, and let's put a hat on things that live in dual twisted space. So in order to go back to momentum space, all we have to do is to perform the inverse Fourier transform. On the mu tildes. And introduce back the lambdas. Okay? On our object over there. Okay? So our object has the integral over C with the measure. So in fact, let me put all this into a symbol I'm going to call capital D. So capital D is a full GLK invariant measure. Contains this and all this. Okay. Now let me write this and split it up. After all, we're going to break our nice, beautiful object W into pieces. We're going to do something violent to it, right? We're going to Fourier transform half of it. So let's give up the W and just split it up, okay? So we're going to split it into from 1 to M delta 2. So we have the sum over C alpha A lambda tilde A. We have sum of C alpha A mu A and 0 slash 4 sum over C alpha A eta tilde. Okay, so we're going to perform this Fourier transform, and that will affect only this piece. So let's write these guys explicitly. So we're going to replace this by an integral over d rho. We need how many of them? We need m of them. So we're going to put an index alpha here. We're going to represent this as I rho sum over C alpha A mu A tilde. Okay? This rho, of course, is a spinner that carries an index alpha. So rho can also be thought of as a 2 by M matrix. Okay? And this contraction is the usual contraction between rho and mu, the spinor contraction. Now we can swap the orders of integration, the mu and the rho integrations. Okay? After all, I want to perform the rho integrations completely. Any questions of this one? So this is just a simple manipulation. I just really want to get rid of mu tilde and be left with only a function of lambda. So when I swap, let me collect everything that contains this variable. Okay? Mu A, a particular mu A. So what is it going to look like? Well, it's going to look like mu A surely has this piece. Right? But from there, I'm going to get something that looks like the sum over alpha from 1 to m C alpha A rho alpha. I'm collecting everything that has a mu A here. Okay? A particular mu A. Sorry, I'm using the same A for all the time, but But you know what I mean. Here this is a sum over A from 1 to N. So if we can collect a particular mu A, we'll have contributions from all alphas, okay, from 1 to N. Collecting everybody, this is what it looks like. Now it's trivial to perform this delta function, to perform this integral, and get a delta function of the form okay. So to make Pedro happy, I think that this is what he had in mind, that in momentum space, we could also talk about planes. After all, if you collect the data that we have in momentum space, say, for particle one, we put the spinner one in a column here, and the spinner two here. For the second particle, we put it here. Now this is the index, this capital A index I was talking about before, where A goes from 1 to 2. And we do this. Okay? We do this for the lambdas. We do the same thing for the lambda tildes. Okay? Now, once again, the data looks like N two vectors here, and here another set of N two vectors. Well, but we now know the trick. We want to exchange this and say that we really have two N vectors and two N vectors here. So is that meaningful? Well, what is the Lorentz group? The Lorentz group is SL2C, right? But what if you complexify the Lorentz group? If you complexify the Lorentz group, then you have two copies of SL2C, each one of them acting independently on the lambdas and the lambda tildes as a multiplication on the left. So that's almost like what we had before. It's telling us that really the scattering data, even here, depends on two planes in CN. Okay? So I want to call these two planes the lambda plane. And this one, the lambda tilde plane. Okay? So I would like to challenge you a little bit. While I erase some of the black words there, try to see what this delta function is telling you. Okay? The previous delta function on top there, on the lambda tilde, is clearly the same condition that we had here for the W's, but now for the lambdas, right? So the first delta function on top there, so the one on the very top here, is telling you that you're integrating over M planes that are orthogonal to this lambda tilde plane. But now the challenge is to figure out, you should figure out what this delta function is telling you about the relation between the lambda plane and the M plane that we're integrating over. Okay? So try to think about that. Okay, we're done. Now. Okay, very good. So, anyone? Time's up. Okay, so let me write the formula again here in momentum space. Okay. Well, let's do it together. Okay. So what is this saying? This is saying that one of the columns of the lambda plane, say the first column, happens to be a linear combination of the m columns of the C plane, of the C matrix. Okay? That's what this is saying, right? If you pick up, there is a 2 here, perhaps that's what's confusing. This 2 is a 2 of the label of the row index. Okay? If you just write this down for a particular row, this will look like a single delta function multiplied m times. Okay? And it would look like from 1 to m, C alpha A, the one component of this matrix row. Remember I said that row was a 2 by m, so the first column of row, minus the row index of the lambda space. So the eighth component of the row vector, of the first row vector, is given as a linear combination of the first component of the eighth component of the k of the m vectors that we have in the C matrix. Is that clear?
Plane is in the C plane.
Excellent.
Yeah. So if this vector is a linear combination of the k the m vectors that were drawn here before, it means that this vector belongs to the m plane. But I'm doing the same thing for the second one. So the second vector here is also a linear combination of the m vectors that define my m plane. Therefore, this vector also belongs to the m plane. If the two basis vectors belong to the m plane, it means that my little 2 plane belongs to the m plane itself. So I can draw the picture here. Once again, here is our m plane. Okay? And we just discovered that these delta functions are imposed in that the lambda plane is contained in the m plane. These delta functions are telling us what we said before, that the lambda tilde plane is orthogonal to the m plane. But note that this is also telling you something interesting already. What is the relationship between lambda tilde and the lambda plane? They are now perpendicular to each other. Is that something that we can recognize? Is that a property that, I mean, is that something meaningful? That's momentum conservation. So we just discovered that momentum conservation is nothing but the statement that the lambda plane and the lambda tilde plane are orthogonal to each other. Well, how do we impose that? Well, we ask every row of the lambda plane to be orthogonal to every row of the lambda tilde plane, and that condition can be written as the sum over A, the A index, over every component of this and every component of this, sum over A, must be 0. But this is nothing but PA, A, B dot, sum over A. So this thing is also encoding immediately momentum conservation. It's inside here. Well, how about the relationship between the lambda tilde plane, between the lambda plane and our Grassmann plane? Remember, our Grassmann plane here, this delta function is telling us that our M plane is also orthogonal to a 0/4 plane, somehow in the Grassmann direction. Well, the fact that the lambda plane is contained in the M plane means that also the lambda plane is orthogonal to this 0/4 vector. And that orthogonality condition can be written as which I hope you recognize, right? So we have automatically encode in this formula momentum conservation and its superpartner. Well, you would say, so what? I mean, having something that momentum has momentum and the superpartner doesn't mean that it has anything to do with scattering amplitudes. But I'm going to give you now a few examples that I hope will encourage you, okay? The first one is to say, well, let's take M to be zero, and let's see if we get the right answer. Well, this formula is telling us, let's integrate over the space of zero planes that contain a two plane. What do you think you should get?
Zero. These delta functions are just giving you zero.
Well, but that's fantastic. We just reproduce an infinite number of amplitudes. Okay? So that's very encouraging. How about M equals 1? Well, we're integrating over the space of all one planes that contain a two plane. Well, tough luck. That also happens to be 0. Well, let's go to the other end. Let's set M equals to N. So we're integrating over the space of N planes that contain a two plane. Sure, that's possible. But what else we have to require?
Yeah, that our
N plane, which is now the full CN, must be orthogonal to a two plane that lives in the same space. But that's impossible. Likewise, this is also impossible. You may wonder now, how come, is there any connection between that and this? Well, in fact, if you look at the books, or it's just easy to imagine that from the geometric description, the space of M planes in M dimensions must be isomorphic to the space of M minus M planes in N dimensions, okay? This is an isomorphism of Grassmannians. But in our setup, remember, this is only swapping the number of minus helicity particles with the number of plus helicity particles. But what's that? That's parity. It's a parity transformation. So parity transformation is nothing but, or parity invariance is nothing but the statement of the isomorphisms of the Grassmannians. So that's also very encouraging. Now let's try to do M equals 2. Okay? Here, surely, it's the first case where we can get something non-zero. So what is it that we get? Well, we're supposed to integrate over the space of two planes that contain a particular two plane. Is there any integration to be done? Well, I would say that we're stuck, right? It should be the same plane. So if it's the same plane, so every time we see the C matrix, in this case, the C matrix is just a 2 by M matrix. Up to a linear transformation, these guys are supposed to be given by these guys, right? Well, we could choose a gauge where they are precisely that, okay? So if we choose that gauge, now know that our formula tells us that we have, first of all, in the denominator, we have the 2 by 2 minors of this object, okay, in the denominator. All of them from 1 to n, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, and so on. So we have the minors 1, 2, 2, 3, all the way to M1. But if this matrix happens to be the lambda matrix, a given minor is nothing but the antisymmetric contraction of these two vectors. But that was the Lorentz invariant contraction. In fact, the Lorentz group, which is a cell to C, is precisely the thing that defines the two-plane. And the Flocker coordinates, which were the determinants, were designed to be invariant under that. So I can very happily replace these minors by the angular brackets that I hope you now know and love. Okay? Now just putting lambdas instead of C's in that formula on top will give us immediately momentum conservation, as we argue. instead of C's, I'm putting lambdas in the lambda tilde integrand and in the lambda tilde delta functions. Also, in the supersymmetric one, so I'm just putting an A here to put everything together. I'm not multiplying, I'm not saying this A is instead. I could also write it as 1 to 2 delta 4 or 0 slash 4. But I don't want to write this because this is not the way I did it before. So I'm putting 2 times 4, 8 into a single delta function. Okay? Well, now you can sit down and compute the Fajekov-Yakovian carefully and everything. But you could also say, well, just from the little group properties and dimensional analysis, this is all it can be. Because all you could pick is a Jacobian of the Fajekov gauge fixing that you have to do. But then you can argue that the Jacobian can just be one. It cannot be anything else. Which formula?
No. Formula does not respect the little group, so you will not.
No, the little group is something you can check. The little group is something you can check.
Without doing the integral meaning. Ah, okay, of course, yes.
Yeah, no, there is no integral. I still haven't told you what the contour of integration is in general. Mm-hmm. I haven't done any integrals yet. Okay. All right, very good.
So you're done with m equals 3 now? I hope everybody did it. Now, I don't expect you to do m equals 3 because it's really the first time we have to perform an integration, right? So I have to tell you what the contour is, and I haven't told you that. But before I tell you that, let's do something different. Let's take that formula on top and actually, before telling you what the contour is, let's try to determine the dimension over which we have to perform the integral. Okay? So let's do some counting. Of the number of degrees of freedom that we have in the integrand so that we know what is the dimension of the integral we have to do. Okay? So let's start. Well, what are the variables we have? We have C's, of which we have M times N. Those are the ones we see there. We also have, as integration variables, the rows, which we have, which are 2 times M, okay? But we have many delta functions there, okay? Well, before taking into account the delta functions, we should say that everything is GLM invariant. So we should subtract m squared. Now we should take into account the delta functions, which would be removing degrees of freedom from the integrand. So what do we have? The first set of delta functions will give us 2m. The fermionic delta functions really don't do anything, right? This is just a polynomial in the numerator, so we shouldn't take them into account. The remaining part will give us 2n, the last delta functions at the very right. But we know that four of these delta functions are not effective. They are not doing anything to the rows or the C's, right? Because they are supposed to produce these guys. They are supposed to constrain our data. So four of these delta functions are not effective. Okay? So
the fermionic ones are not
imposing any constraints, right? This is just a polynomial in the numerator. On the integration variables, they are not doing anything. So as you can clearly see, this is, of course, what else can it be, right? If it's not that, please don't tell me. Go ahead and check it here. Yes, I think it has to be there. Okay. So that means that our integral is an integral over that many variables. And we would like to say that it's actually a contour integral. In C with this dimension. Now you can immediately see that m equals 2 is fine, it works, right? All the m's that we talk about gives negative dimensions or gives 0, so that's fine. So if you do m equals 3, it's the first time you get integrations. And if you do m equals 3 and n equals 6, that's fantastic because this number is 1. So it's just an integral over one complex dimension. It's just a contour integral. You get something that has poles in the denominator. And it's meaningful to just carry out all, use all the delta functions to explicitly solve for every variable that you can. And you will be left with something that looks like this. Say for 6 variables, I'm going to call tau the leftover variable, okay? Out of all the variables that we have there, we use all the delta functions, we're left with a single parameter, which I'm going to call tau. And this function will have poles where the minors vanish, okay? So you have 6 minors there. Now, the C matrix in this case is 3 by n. But remember that the first 2 rows are not very interesting, right? They are supposed somehow to contain the lambda plane. So the tau dependence cannot be there. So the tau dependence can only be in the final row. And therefore, each minor can only be linear in the variables. So each minor is a linear function. Let me call it AI. So if you have the minor I plus 1, I plus 2, this can only be linear in my integration variable.
Only to motivate that they are linear, because I'm not computing this for you. In any case, they will be linear. This is a gauge-independent statement. Now, well, this is a contour integral where it's there. Let's move on here. Okay. So that's a contour integral, and we have the tau thing. And we have 6 poles. Okay. Now the poles were minors 1, 2, 3 vanish, say minor 2, 3, 4 vanish, 3, 4, 5 vanish, 4, 5, 6. 561 and 612. Okay? Now you can just compute these residues and get a rational function of each residue will be a rational function of the brackets, the Lorentz invariant inner products. That's all it can be. Okay? Now you compute these 6 residues and you say, well, what should I do with them? Clearly, if we sum over all of them, we get 0 by Cauchy's theorem. So clearly, summing over all of them is not correct. The other approach, the other scientific approach, is that you compute all of them and then you scan every paper in the literature to see if you see anything that you recognize. You do that, and surprisingly, it works. Okay? Every one of these 6 objects was there in the literature at some point. So that's a very scientific way of proceeding. And they turn out these 3. Turn out to be precisely the ones that give you the 3-level amplitude for the in the 3.6 sector. Okay? So it's a sum of 3 terms. And this is what came out of what Dima will explain today as the DCFW recursion relations. Okay? And as we have been expressing, each of these guys contain very unphysical, non-local poles that tells you that each of them are very alien objects. But we also tried to say, we also have been advertising the fact that when you combine them in a particular way, they will give you something that is physical, that has a physical space-time interpretation.
And it turns out that the sum of these three gives you such an interpretation. Now, we also said that trying to
prove that the spurious guys or the non-local poles cancel is quite miraculous. I mean, it's a quite miraculous cancellation, in which is very, very hard to do. But here, it turns out that the non-local poles that you get from these three things are different from the non-local poles that you get from these three things here. And therefore, if you perform a contour deformation, you can write this down as minus the other three. But now, if a pole is here but it's not here, it cannot really be a pole. It should cancel. It must cancel. So only the physical poles appear in both, and the unphysical poles are different in both expressions. So just a residue theorem is telling you that this expression is local. So this is just the first sign that the residue theorem is encoding locality. It's a funny thing because it's a topological property encoding something that in space-time has to do with locality. Very good. So the final thing I would like to do today is the following, is to say, well, if you look at this number, it's very tempting to recognize this number as follows and say, what if you call m tilde m minus 2 and n tilde m minus 4? Let's just make that substitution in the dimension of this space. What do we find? We find that the dimension of this space is C m tilde minus m tilde. But you should recognize this number as being the dimension of a Grassmannian. Right? Remember I told you that the Grassmannian, if you have a Grassmannian of m tilde planes in C m tilde, the dimension is m tilde times m tilde, which is the number of entries in the matrix, minus the dimension of the gauge group, which is m tilde squared. And that number happens to be this. Now, there seem to be in the game a Grassmannian or an m tilde plane in n tilde dimensions. What is that? Can we actually see why this integral wants to be an integral over that Grassmannian and not over what I'm trying to force it to be? Well, let's try to see intuitively that this is actually the right space of integration. So let's start by saying, well, we started with our M plane, but we are forcing the M plane to contain a particular two plane that is fixed. So our integration is not really over an M plane, it's really over an M minus two plane. Okay? Well, that's starting to match. Now, our M minus two plane, can it move in all N dimensions? Well, it can't, because it has to be orthogonal to the two plane that was contained in the original M plane, and it has to be orthogonal to the lambda tilde plane that the original M plane was orthogonal to. So there are four dimensions that are completely useless. Our little M minus two plane cannot go into those four dimensions. So our M minus two plane is living in M minus four dimensions. Well, that's precisely right. Okay? So motivated by that, you would say, well, could we try to actually write the integral in a way that integrates over m minus two planes rather than m planes, okay? Moreover, you could say, well, can we actually write the integral as an integral over this space, okay? Not just over m minus two planes in n dimensions, but also over m minus two planes in m minus four dimensions. Well, it turns out that we know how to do the former, not the latter. And I'll tell you what it is. So we want to take the original formula and write it as an integral over m minus two planes in n dimensions. Well, I can give you a motivation. Yeah, that's what I really would like to do, but that, I don't know how to do it yet. This is an intermediate step, if you want. I don't know how to do it in a nice way. So that what I know how to do in a nice way is this step. But the final step, I don't know any nice formula for that. So let me just give you a motivation of the formula that I'm going to write, which I can motivate with the case m equals 3. Okay. So in the case m equals 3, we start with our space, 3n dimensional, and we have the minus 1, 2, 3, all the way to n1, 2, 3. Okay. n1, 2. So we can choose part of the GL3 to gauge fix the raw matrix to be 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0. The raw matrix is a 2x3 matrix, okay? So we're eating up from here 6 of the gauge degrees of freedom, so we're left with only 3, okay? And when we do this gauge fixing, note what it does. It's telling us this is forcing the first two rows of the C matrix to be precisely the lambda plane. So this is forcing the C matrix to have the form and some C here. Okay, by this I'm denoting the raw vectors. So this gauge fixing enforces that. Okay, once I do that, all the delta functions of the first two rows become precisely momentum conservation and super momentum conservation. So they factor out, and my integral becomes an integral over the single row that is left over. Okay, so it's just n-dimensional. Well, I can keep it like this if I want, but I can also remove the row index. My minors, what do they look like? Well, if I have the minor I plus 1, I plus 2 of this matrix, it nicely becomes the product of minors of this 2x2 of this 2x n matrix and just products of together with independent components with components of this row. Well, it's just an exercise. Just take one of these guys, compute it explicitly, and you will find that it turns out to be this. Let's see. So if I have this. Okay, it's just a simple exercise to show that the minor of this matrix, II plus 1, I plus 2, becomes exactly equal to this. Now, you should start recognizing this formula. If you look at your notes from yesterday, when Nima was telling you about these new fancy variables that make life very, very simple, they had some flavor like this. They started to look like this. Well, it turns out that if you look at the leftover degrees of freedom here, what is that? Well, it's that breaks GL3 to just an overall rescaling times the space of translations in two dimensions. You can call it T2 here, no, not to confuse it with that. What is this? Well, it's saying that you can take the C matrix, the leftover component, and rescale it. Or you could also translate it by any vector that is proportional to the first two rows. Okay?
Sorry? Oh, in the last.
Yeah, thank you. This is not I minus 1. Yeah. This is I. Oh. This is I plus 1. So this was I plus 1, I plus 2, and I. Thank you. Yeah, there isn't even an I minus 1 anywhere. Okay. Great. Very good. So now you can use these translations to finish the job and gauge fix and define new variables so that these minors look like new variables, B, I, okay? And translate that into something that will look like this. I'm just going to write down the final formula for you. It's going to look like this. So we said that we're pulling out immediately the super momentum delta function. Now I'm going to write it now for any for all m. Yeah. So the exercise for you is to fill up the gaps in m equals 3 and then generalize it to any m. Now, it turns out that our D variables will become the components of what we're going to call a D matrix, which is now M minus 2. And remember, this was my K, right? That's why I insisted in changing my notation, because it's going to be more useful to talk about K. It will appear more times N. And remember that this two-dimensional plane was roughly the MHV amplitude, right? This Park-Taylor amplitude was the thing that we obtained by locking everything to be these two planes. Well, it turns out that the analogy is so spectacular that, in fact, the whole Park-Taylor amplitude factors out of the formula. It completely factors out. And we are left over with an integral, in fact, over the space of m minus 2 planes. Okay. Quite miraculously, under this change of variables, when you generalize this to any m, the minors, this is quite non-trivial, the minors of the m by m matrix go nicely into minors of the go into k by k minors of these smaller metrics. So now you have well, how about the delta functions? What happens to them? Well, what happens is quite interesting. On the support of these delta functions, remember that these momentum twisters that Nima was talking about yesterday were variables that make momentum conservation trivial, as well as the on-shellness condition trivial, right? With any momentum twisters that you like, you can produce a set of momenta that satisfy momentum conservation, and all of them are null vectors automatically. So on the support of these delta functions, it turns out that this object can be written just as a function of the momentum twisters. So we're going to introduce a notation. Well, Nima already did. He said that ZA is made out of this, where mu A, the lambda A, he said it was the same lambda A that we have here, but mu A is related to the lambda tilde by an interesting relation, which is basically the relation that we have here. So A plus 1. Sorry, yeah, about that one. What did they do? So this one should be what? This one should be A. Sorry, what am I doing?
Yes.
Let's see. I'm now not even counting correctly. This is A plus 1, A minus 1. Yes, so that's all I want to do. I want to cycle this one, but I... So somehow it's cycling in the wrong direction. Okay, let
this start over. So I want to put
it is A plus 1 here, A minus 1 here, mu A here, and then I want to put A here, A plus 1 here, and mu A minus 1 here. all this divided by a minus 1 k a plus 1. So this is a formula that Nima gave you yesterday. And it turns out that in terms of these new variables, this eta is related to the old etas in the same way. So we just replace here by eta a tilde. Okay? It's given by these new etas put here. Okay? And in terms of these new variables, the surprise is the following. It's quite miraculous. The answer is the product from alpha equals to 1 to n, sorry, to k, delta 4 slash 4 sum over d alpha a za from a equals to 1 to n. Well, look at this. And that for this was in twister, in dual twister space. And look at the formula in momentum twister space. It's this piece. It's identical to this. All we did was to exchange the labels C by D, M by K, and W's by Z. So this is saying that when you compute something with this object, it's also invariant under a new symmetry, which is isomorphic to the original superconformal group. And this is what is called the dual superconformal group. Okay? So we are discovering that anything that you compute with this formula is both from the top line is superconformal invariant. And from the bottom line is dual superconformal.
Third amplitude, not dual superconformal invariant.
Yeah, that's very good. That's very good. So that's what I was about to say. So this whole thing is superconformal invariant because that's the thing that comes from here. Okay. This bit here is dual superconformal invariant. Now, if you want to study what happens when you put the two things together, you either have to see how the transformation on this will behave as you push this through, or how the superconformal transformations behave as you pass them through this guy and out from this guy, right? Now, nobody was expecting anything spectacular to happen, but it turns out that Drummond, Plevka, and I think it was Hen, yeah, they decided to do it. Just pass the thing through, the superconformal guys, pass them through here, and see what happens. Well, first of all, this dual superconformal action on this object, is very easy, right? The representation is just the following. The way the superconformal group acts is as follows.
Okay, this is the usual form of the generators. Likewise, the same form of the generators happens to act on these guys here, but now with Z's replaced by W's. So they took these generators, translated them back to momentum space, and passed them through this MHV amplitude. And they realize that when they act on this thing, the superconformal group acting just on this bit turns out to look like this. So let me give a name to this and say zero, because are the first ones that you compute. So these ones turn out to be a sum over This structure comes from the fact that you have to pass it through this guy, okay? Okay, so let's call these ones one because these are the second ones you computed. Now that looks quite nice. Well, but if it had been me, the one who computed this, I have said, well, it looks interesting, but I don't know what it is. But somebody who works in integrability would immediately say, wow, this thing looks interesting. If on top of these relations, we can show that they satisfy some other technical relation, which is called the Serret equation, or the Serret relation, which is in fact too long for me to write it. But our friends show that these guys actually do satisfy that relation. Then commutators, nested commutators of this is called level zero. Well, now you know the zero. And this is level one. Level one generators, together with this relation, ensure that you can generate an infinite dimensional symmetry algebra. Called the Yang-Yang. Now it's a Yang-Yang, but it's a Yang-Yang of something. It's a Yang-Yang of the level zero algebra that you had. So it's a Yang-Yang of SL4/4. Or the fancy name, DSU2,2/4, if you want. Okay? So we just discovered that residues, or quantities that you compute with this integral, are objects that are Yang-Yang invariant, okay? That are manifestly invariant under both, we like to say, superconformal invariants and dual superconformal invariants. But now you know precisely what we mean when we say that. We mean invariant under this infinite dimensional symmetry algebra, okay? And today, Nima will show you how to do many things with this, how to compute residues with this object. Okay. Know that now this you can treat these bosonic delta functions as if Nima will tell you what to do with this object. We don't have time now to go into details. It's very tempting, but yeah, I'll not do it.
The second form, the dimension decreased.
Yeah.
Well, can you continue?
Yeah.
Well, remember that to go to this formula, to that formula over there, we had to perform a Fourier transform, right? And then in the new space, we could factor this guy. Now you could again take this guy, Fourier transform, and keep on doing it. Yeah. Oh, that's the first thing that everybody tried to understand what happens when you keep doing that. But it's not clear what it means, because once you Fourier transform, remember that you want to get something that is nice in this space. Right? Something that is, yeah, so let me say something. Something that in momentum space is completely regular, a nice rational function, must be something that comes from Twistor space, which is very, very distributional, which only has very singular support. As we know, right, it's a Fourier transform. So if you want something smooth in this space, you need something very, very singular in this space. Now, when you keep going, you will now, if you want something smooth in this space, you will then have to find something very singular in the other space. Perhaps what you could do is to take collinear singularities in this space and describe them as smooth and nice objects in the next space. That's something that could be done. These are some of the things that you were doing with CSW. You could perhaps imagine that you can take the collinear singularities, the places where you have collinear singularities, and keep going, and they will produce nice smooth objects in the next steps. But I don't think any that one that doesn't open problem. Nobody has actually made any reasonable and good use of the fact that these two formulas are exactly equal and that you can keep going. I don't think anybody has done anything with that.
So what is the hierarchy of Twistor space you get? Because you start from zero Twistor space, you get momentum Twistor space.
Right, so now you can try to go further.
This one, what's
again, this? Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Nobody has found any use for those. Yeah, there is yet
another space that you can define, which is now, it would be a dual momentum space, not a Twistor space, because you have to pass through the momentum space first. And then you can define the dual twister space of that, and then keep going. Yeah. Okay? So starting tomorrow, the course will basically split into two. So in the morning, I'll take over the part that will be, that we can say is related to extracting space-time from this formula, or things that at the beginning of the lecture yesterday said were manifest in the description of, in the local description of the scattering amplitudes related to manifest locality in space-time, how to extract them from this formula. That will be my part. And in the afternoon, Nima will take over and show you how to extract the full quantum mechanical amplitude, okay? The full amplitude or the full integrand, quantum mechanical integrand from this formula as well, okay? So in the morning, space-time, in the afternoon, quantum mechanics. So starting tomorrow, we decouple the two. And okay, so I'll see you in the afternoon. Thank you.